Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this episode of the Bruin Podcast, I'm going to be talking to Jonathan Platt, Head of Fixed Income at Royal London Asset Management. And we're going to be discussing investing ethically in fixed income sector, where I want to understand how that approach can be applied to time-limited fixed return investments that don't afford the investor any kind of vote. Now, before we get into that, bear in mind we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin, tax legislation and allowances can change, and when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that in the past. And now, with those warnings out of the way, we can get to the heart of this topical and fairly complex subject. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Bruin podcast with me, Guy Foster. I'm the head of research here at Bruin Dolphin, and I'm joined by Jonathan Platt. And Jonathan is the head of fixed income at Royal London Asset Management. So, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Guy.
One of the things that we have talked about in previous podcasts is more sustainable SRI type approaches to investing in equities. We have not yet had a discussion about applying SRI principles to the fixed income universe. And one of the funds that Bruin Dolphin uses to do that is the Royal London Ethical Bond Fund. I wondered if he could just explain to us how the principles of the fund work and how you apply them to the debt asset class.
Yeah, thanks, Guy. I think, first of all, I would say it's interesting that you asked that question because fixed income generally hasn't been at the forefront of ethical and sustainable investing. It's very much been an equity concept. But we've been running our ethical bond fund under Eric Holt now for, well, 15 years plus. So it's a well-established fund in the Royal London Asset Management range. Basically, we felt that it was important to offer our clients a clear choice of how their money is used for investment purposes. And so when we developed the Ethical Bond Fund, we looked at five key areas of markets where we felt that some of our clients wouldn't want to invest, wouldn't want their money used to support these activities. And these were tobacco, armaments, gambling, pornography, and alcohol. And if a business or an issuing entity had more than 10% of its turnover coming from one or more, i.e., the aggregate five, we wouldn't invest. So in practice, that meant we're not lending to British American Tobacco or Imperial Brands or Diageo as examples, or any of the gambling companies like Flutter, for example. So those are the areas that we excluded. Now, as you can imagine, people's views on ethical investment will evolve over time. So we've also included three other areas where we are cautious on investment. So animal testing, it has to be a clear area for benefit, not for cosmetics, for example. It's for health reasons, human rights, and the environment. And the environment's an interesting one now coming really to the fore. And as well as having that as a factor within our consideration, environmental considerations are just embedded throughout Royal London Asset Management as one of the three core risks of environment, social, and governance risk, those ESG risks that we're familiar with. They have to be analysed as part of credit analysis for every strategy or fund that we're running, let alone sustainable or in this case, an ethical fund. Does that answer the question you wanted, Guy?
Well, it does partly, but I think it raises a couple of other questions. I'm wondering if you've talked about a couple of different things there, an ethical approach to investing, which might be based upon what people feel comfortable that their money is using to support. So a sort of a moralistic judgment, and then ESG risk management, which is much more about, or arguably much more about, supporting still your financial objectives. You still want to make money, but you want to make money by avoiding a particular kind of or particular set of risks, these kind of ESG risks, which presumably is that's what you're talking about when you talk about ESG being integrated throughout Royal London's investment approach.
Absolutely. And I think this is absolutely, if I spend a couple of minutes just talking about that, because this is at the crux of some of the confusions that lie around investing generally. So if I go back a step, in assessing whether we lend to a company as a bond investor, we want to consider the risks, and we need to consider the risk broadly in two areas: the financial risk. What's the balance sheet like? What's basically how much debt has it got? Can it service that debt? How volatile is that business model? But if we're lending for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, it's really difficult to know how a company will financially evolve over those periods. But you can look at some of those longer term impacts like environmental, social and governance risk. You know, if we don't think the company is governed properly, if the board structure is inappropriate, that's a red flag. And that basically means that we won't invest, but it means that we're very cautious and we will need to be paid a lot more to take that risk than if that wasn't a red flag on a guns factor. So none of these are exclusions. They are the way we price risk into our portfolios. And these ESG are just as valid as financial risks. So it's a way of us as fund managers and credit analysts saying, you know, for our clients' money, what risk are we prepared to take? And are we getting fair compensation for that risk? And that's where that analysis comes in. Now, taking that to our ethical bond fund, all of that analysis is done to support the choice of that we make. But on top of that, it doesn't matter how much compensation we are being paid to take a tobacco company risk. So British American Tobacco, as I mentioned earlier, Japan Tobacco, for example, we just won't invest in it. Even if we felt that actually that's quite reasonable compensation, it's just a hard exclusion within the portfolio. So that's where the two come together. The first part, that ESG analysis, is just all embracing, looking to see whether we're being paid the risk. The second part, that ethical part, is saying, well, actually, there are no prices. Our clients who are investing in this fund do not want their money used in those particular areas that we've chosen. Now, other managers may have different forms of values, those moral choices, those ethical criteria. And clients will choose which parameters, which constraints, which exclusions most suit their stance. But I think the eight that we've now got are pretty encompassing of what clients looking for an ethical investment want to exclude from their portfolio. So, clarify, Guy.
Yeah. So how do you make that judgment about what clients are looking for in an ethical portfolio?
I think that's basically interaction with our clients. As I say, this fund goes back a long time now. And when we were setting up that fund, these were the types of issues that our clients were saying, well, look, we don't want our money used in these particular areas. But as I said, we've also amended that to include three new ones. So it's a fluid situation. Now, we don't want to chop and change because our clients have the confidence of knowing where their money is being used. But we also have to recognize that we're not in a static situation, that ethical values will change over a period of time. And therefore, we need the ability to amend if we see that there is an area now that is of greater concern. And certainly, you can see that in terms of environmental issues coming much more to the fore. Now, that is not a hard exclusion from our portfolios, but it is certainly something that we will consider very carefully on the exposures that we have on those that have weaker ESG scores.
Now, as you've mentioned, these things, these risks, and also, I guess, these moral judgments, they do evolve over time. And I think one of the things that you and I have discussed in the past has been the raising prominence, I suppose, of issues associated with China and the ESG or judgments that we might make about investing, supplying money to institutions that deal with China. So, I mean, thinking about some headline names, I think HSBC would be an obvious one at the moment, where people are having to where the situation's developing very quickly. company finds itself in an awkward position. How do you assess that through those two lenses within Royal London?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. First of all, I'd say that HSBC is held within the portfolio, and there is nothing within those ethical exclusions that would prevent us holding that. So that's the first point. However, the second point, which I think is more where you're coming from, is, well, how do you assess those ESG risks within something like HSBC? So basically, that's where our credit analysts and the fund managers work closely together to say, look, HSBC has some challenges. It has some challenges in its position in China. It's had some challenges in relation to governance, and it's had some events over the last few years where its practices have been found wanting. What we do with in terms of that analysis is say, well, look, we need, in the case of HSBC, to factor that into our pricing of that risk. Now, this is not a science. This has to be come back to our analysts making a judgment on what risks we're prepared to take for our clients, what compensation that we're getting in for holding those bonds. Now, one thing, not wanting to confuse the situation, but within Royal London Asset Management, and you may be familiar with Mike Fox as one of our key equity investors, we run a sustainable range. And that, you know, that's quite interesting, because there you're looking at those companies that are exhibiting the very best practice in their area. And that's HSBC is the one where we've had a lot of debate on, but within that specific range. So in the ethical bond fund that we're talking about today, we hold it, it's not excluded, but we have to get compensated for the risks that we perceive, those longer term risks.
Right. Okay. Yes. Well, we do know Mike very well. He's been also a guest on the Bruin podcast a couple of months ago, or late September. So hopefully listeners will be familiar with Mike and his work. So now you've talked about getting compensated for the risks. Is it the case then that companies with these higher ESG risks, or for that matter, companies in sectors which might not appeal to other investors taking an ethical approach, are they offering greater compensation? Is there some money that's being left on the table that that these more discriminating approaches are missing out on?
I think that the answer to that is no. The reason I answer in no is that the ethical bond fund has now been around for a long period of time, as I said right at the beginning, and we've been through various market and economic cycles, as you can imagine, over that very long period of time. And we've been able to demonstrate that the performance of our ethical bond fund is in line, if not slightly better, than the performance of our unconstrained fund. So at the bottom line, over that long period, we can absolutely say that an ethical exclusion policy is not to the detriment of the financial return. And that is absolutely crucial, because then we can go out to our clients and say, look, over the longer term, those ethical constraints that we put in place, the exclusions, have not disadvantaged you. And so therefore, using your money in the way that you want it to be used, you're not sacrificing the return. Now, if I go back to perhaps the here and now, it may look as if, you know, if I'm not buying a British American tobacco that yields 2 percentage points over government bonds, where the rest of the market is yielding perhaps 1.5, so it's giving you a higher yield, but it may be riskier, it may be more volatile, and we can use that money elsewhere to generate a similar level of return. So when you go down to the individual stocks, it may look as if you're giving up return, but over that longer term period that we're talking about, actually no evidence, and indeed slightly to the contrary, that we've done really well with these exclusions within the portfolio.
I mean, those kind of excess returns, I guess, are certainly something that trouble us as equity investors, because as an equity investor, you're taking a sort of a very, very long term view. The valuation theoretically is looking forward to what the world could be like many decades in the future. As a bond investor, I mean, you've obviously got a fixed maturity. And so I wonder, do these ESG risks, do they genuinely kind of crystallize in during the investment horizon that a bond investor might be worried about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good challenge there, because, again, going back to that tobacco example, you know, if I'm lending for 5 years to a tobacco company, I'm still not sure what's going to happen over that 5 year period, but the chances of not getting your money back and not getting the coupon paid over that period looks fairly low. But I could lend to that company or a set of companies for 40 or 50 years, and then I'm not sure at all what the situation will be. So I think there is a time issue that we have to absolutely consider. However, if we look at, you know, some of the trends that are around there in the fixed income markets at the moment, you know, one thing that we're definitely seeing corporately is life cycles speeding up, disruptive investments, strategies coming in that long established companies that have been around for a long period of time are finding their market share being eroded either by technology or a different approach to the way we do things. So you really do have to consider these longer term risk factors, because they are absolutely relevant. You know, key case in point is the decarbonizing of the UK economy. You know, a large part of carbon emissions comes from heating domestic houses. The government is committed to changing that to reduce gas as a heating source for houses in a very short period of time, really. Yes. And that's going to, for example, give, you know, quite a challenge to our gas infrastructure. And there are bonds out there in the marketplace that have been issued for 30 or 40 years. And actually, these changes are happening quite rapidly. And there has to be a question of, is that risk being priced into the market? So go back to that question. Absolutely, I think these are very relevant considerations for fixed income investment. But the longer that you are lending, the more and more relevant these become for that assessment.
Can you talk to us a bit about what your interaction is with the issuers? You know, we obviously, the topic of stewardship is a very important one at the moment for investors in all asset classes, and fixed income's under particular scrutiny, I guess, because it hasn't been so much in the past, and now all investors have got to look at this. So what are your stewardship responsibilities? How do you carry them out as fixed income investors?
Yeah, I mean, the key observation I would make to start with is, you know, fixed income, the bondholders are not the owners of the company. So there is an absolutely different relationship between a board of directors, as they have to their shareholders, their owners, and to us as bondholders, who are very important stakeholders, but aren't the owners of the business. So that does affect that relationship. I have to acknowledge that. However, what is absolutely clear to me is that there's been a massive shift over the last 10 years in the way equity markets and fixed income markets function as providing capital. To me, it seems increasingly, certainly within the mature parts of the equity markets, that equity markets there are for the exchange of ownership. They're not really there to provide capital raising, you know, the typical rights issues to raise money for investment projects. That is done now much, much more in fixed income markets. And that does give us a lot more leverage in terms of the influence that we can have. So your question was about engagement. I mean, we absolutely engage with a whole range of companies, not just those that are looking to raise finance, but those that we're having an ongoing dialogue with. You know, examples of this will be property companies. For example, we engage with our property companies on their responses to the need to make their properties more energy efficient. And we had a project of going through our property companies and interacting with them. And actually, some property companies really responded positively to say, look, really glad you're interacting with us, taking that interest in the assets that, in effect, we pledged to you as a bondholder. And we've had some great dialogues. Grosvenor is a classic case in point, owns prime property in the West End of London. We've had dialogue with them, and they're really, really great responses from issuers like that. I should also say that we benefit from having a really active engagement on the equity side. Royal London Asset Management is a really active equity side, and as well as that, the responsible investment team that services both the fixed income teams and the equity teams engage with companies on a regular basis. So engagement is absolutely critical to the way Royal London Asset Management approach things, and we benefit both from our interaction as fixed income investors and more widely from the interaction Royal London Asset Management have with a whole range of companies.
Okay, well, look, this has been a really useful conversation, Jonathan. So thanks very much for taking us through it. I better draw it to a close, but I think before I let you go, I mean, could you talk a bit about what an ethically minded investor can get access to through the bond market, or that perhaps wouldn't be available to them through, say, an equity fund?
Thanks for that, because it was certainly something I wanted to bring out. You know, the way we built our ethical bond portfolio is actually very complementary to an equity fund, in the sense that the actual overlap isn't particularly high. A lot of the bonds that we own don't have an equity equivalent. And again, that goes back to that point about substituting bond capital, really, in effect, bond financing for equity financing. So examples here would be the housing association sector. So in our ethical bond fund, about 15% of the bonds we own, the lending that we do on our clients' behalf, goes to social and affordable housing. Now, you can't get that access in the equity market. We also lend to the likes of the BBC. You can't get equity exposure to the BBC. We invest in infrastructure projects. So road projects, example, hospitals. You know, we lend within the ethical bond fund to a whole range of health areas. So St James's Oncology in Leeds, it's a project that was refinanced, and we own the bond. So there's actually a lot where you get the complementary approach where you can't get access in the equity market. I think the final thing I would say is it's really important within fixed income to get diversification. We make no apology for the diversification within our portfolio. We hold a lot of different issuers. We're spreading that risk around a lot of issuers. And I think it's also important, particularly when you're running an ethical bond fund, that you don't just say, well, these are the exclusions, and therefore we will go to the sectors where it's easiest to get some exposure. So for example, you know, banks, it's easy to pass the ethical criteria in banks. What we don't want to end up in is holding a disproportionate amount in the bank sector, for example. So we're spreading our risk across the sectors, making sure that our clients are getting a very broad range of exposures. And you say from that question, Guy, also picking up on those areas you can't get equity exposure to.
Okay, all right. Well, look, that's been really helpful. So thanks a lot, Jonathan, for talking us through how you apply that ethical approach to investing in fixed income. Thanks also to all of our podcast listeners. Hopefully you've found this conversation as interesting and helpful as I have. And we also really hope that you'll join us again for a future edition of the Bruin podcast. So thanks for listening.